In this episode, I'm going to talk about an edible Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. So this is a diagram which the students can actually eat. This is Peter Hill in Peter Hill Explains, where I talk about things scientific. Firstly, let's say what a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram is. Hertzsprung-Russell diagram is to astrophysics as the periodic table is to chemistry. So in chemistry, there's different elements and it arranges them. In astrophysics, stars are arranged in a way which you can actually describe them. So there's different regions of the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. Now, the diagram itself on the bottom axis has the colour or temperature of the star, because the temperature, surface temperature of the star determines the colour that it appears. And on the vertical axis is the, if you'd like, the wattage or the absolute power of a star. It's the power of a star in watts, as for light bulbs, but where one is the unit of our sun at a fixed distance away. I'm just trying to think, it's 3.2 parsecs. One parsec distance, 3.2 light years. Is a fixed distance away to get the absolute brightness of a star. So this is how it's actually calculated, but in general the brightness is 1 is equal to the brightness of our sun. What happens is there's, there's a reclining banana lounge chair. It's sort of the back, there's a seat area and a leg area going from left to right, and that is if you would like stars which are no longer growing but are just burning the fuel at their birth, and they burn at a constant rate, and they burn in such a way that they become naked. They actually shed the gas and blow the gas away, and you can actually see deep into the star, and the bigger the star it is, the deeper it burns into the star, so the hotter the star appears. So stars are have a surface temperature, but they get much hotter, up to 15 million or 30 million degrees on the inside. As the temperature increases, the rate of fusion increases. So you have big blue stars burning quickly on that back of the banana chair, going across, and it's called the main sequence. And they're, as they increase in size, they dramatically, or as they increase in temperature, they have to dramatically increase in brightness. And the reason that happens is why there's a change in gradient is there's actually two fusion processes which continue. There's a the fusion process there, that's where little nuclei come together and release energy, so you make elements deeper down the periodic table inside a star. It's actually an element factory. So in that area, it's the carbon nitrogen oxygen cycle, and then around our area of the woods, it's flattened. It's the main sequence is flattened, and that's standard fusion, and then very, very slow fusion as you get down to red dwarfs, the very tiny, dim red stars. And just to give you a idea, there are some. There are very few blue bright stars. They're a rarity, but because they're blue and bright, they're very powerful and bright, you can see them a long distance away. But because they live a very short distance, there's very few of them. So there's a whole lot of competing processes. Where a moderately rare star, it's described as an average star, and it's average for us because it's the most common star, because our eyes are adapted to the light generated, so our eyes can only see stars like us. But the galaxy is chock-a-block full of infrared stars. So if you buy from Aldi your infrared viewer and put it up to the sky at night, the field is absolutely filled with many, many more, 10 times more infrared stars. And they're dimmer, so there's a lot more of them. So you can imagine the stars as fireflies. You're in a cave, and the dim fireflies are very numerous because you can't see them as far. So that's the main sequence. Beneath the main sequence, you get these very hot white dwarf stars, which are the leftover core, the old age. And then you also have, above this main sequence, red stars, which are the red giants. These are stars in which their undressing mechanism has broken down, their surface heating has broken down, the surface evaporation process has broken down, and they just swell and fill up. They choke with sort of their own gas and form a sort of a luminous ball up to, in many cases, outside the orbit of our, or in some cases outside the orbit of our solar system. And look, and there's, the process is actually quite complicated. Just a star is born to the main sequence, stays there. But the process of becoming a red giant, it loops around the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. It sort of goes on a tour up there as it goes from red giant. It goes flashes as it sort of kicks gears. It's like a car, a star. As it goes up, it will change gear and goes flashes as it starts on a new type of fusion each time. And as the star actually, its fusion starts to shut down, the surface of the star cools, you get a huge pressure wave, and this pressure wave in the surface of the star creates a burst of fusion in the pressure wave, and there's a the surface of the star begins to evaporate, which builds by recoil that pressure wave. And so your pressure wave actually implodes the star. And so a supernova is first a implosion to compress the entire star, and you have a star-sized nuclear bomb, which you can see from across space. So you can see supernova flashing all the time in other galaxies. So if you just train your telescope on a galaxy for even a couple of years, you'll see the little galaxy flashing a supernova occur. And we've had it there. So that's the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. And we're going to say, why would you want to make it edible? Well, there's a series of astrophysics eating exercise. The one, and we'll just go through them very quickly. One is where you give them a small, or give the students a small cupcake decoration called a cashew, and that's a scale 1 to a trillion. And at that scale, when they hold a in their hand, the other student has to be 41 kilometres to hold the nearest star. So that's a way of suddenly giving a cross. And then if you use the scale of 1 millimeter equals 1,000 light years, you have this is a separate idea of cooking pancakes, a separate scale, and you can cook a galaxy as a pancake, build it up with the various features, and the nearest galaxy to us at that scale is 2 meters away, which is a nice eating distance. And again, the edge of the observable universe, actually back to the Big Bang, where we can see the Big Bang, is again around 43 kilometres away, a dome around it. So it gives a very direct scale. And this one idea is in addition to this to theme of edible astrophysics, of actually making an edible Hertzberg-Russell diagram. Now, the idea of making something edible actually shifts the gear down of age groups in which you can engage and teach this. Now, if you can shift a year down, it means that when they do formally encounter the material, they have, or students have, pre-knowledge. So they might not learn well, but this is an introduction to it. So they may not take away 100%. Let's say they may take 30 or 20% of the available knowledge, but they'll, more importantly, is take away confidence to it. So although this is a very successful rescue lesson, we have burnout students in year 10 who are over science. It's actually what I see is teaching these lessons to the public, but also for year 7, 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds. And the edible aspect of it is a very interesting point. So they've done cognitive attention studies where they give people various problems. So this is talking about the justification of getting a lesson based around food. And so you have the same problem, one abstract and one with food, and the actual studies show that the problem solving ability and the fairness increases massively with food. Now, so food is this amazing thing to teach with. It's this golden thing to teach with, and they've puzzled around these fairly rigorously tested psychological feedback that if you teach, or you set a problem and you set it in terms of food, people have a much greater ability to problem solve. And fundamental aspect of it is that the sharing of food unlocks a whole series of problem solving problems. You've got the social problem solving, you've got the idea of, am I getting a fair share, and is everyone else getting a fair share? So the food preparation process is unlocking a different psychological pathway to learning. So this is why when you teach with food, it's very, very effective. So the other aspect is that the preparation of food can create social and teamwork challenges which are not directly related to science. So the ability to set up a team to do a task to prepare food means that you've got the problem solving and leadership problems, and the basic effectiveness is, do you understand the science to achieve it? So people can get up a model of how to do things first, and then subsequently improve their understanding of science added into it. So we're just going, so it's around Christmas time in Australia, and you're beginning to see a few houses which are really lighting up. Going around him. This is just a flat park walk around the village green. It's a village in the Blue Mountains. It's got a little cricket oval. I'm just walking around that. So we'll go back to the Hertzsprung Russell diagram. Now, basically you need a source of information about the brightness and colour of stars. Now, that is provided by Celestia, a downloadable galaxy, which you can put in your computer and allows you to manoeuvre in three dimensions around the galaxy. And by moving your mouse, you can actually travel quickly between stars and start to look at different stars, control the time of stars, so you have a pair of stars and you can increase the speed of their orbit by a few thousand times or a million times, so you can see stars orbiting and the planets orbiting. So it allows you to effortlessly and cognitively move between as it appears and over time. So it's got a beautiful aspect of it, this particular program called Celestia. And in a previous blog I've provided a download to it. So we've got the Celestia as a source of brightness of stars and the colour of stars. Now, you can give instructions on how to extract the information and set up a very rigorous way which produces information within a rigorous time for a teacher observe, you know, if you've been observed and tested, which I'm often, more often than not. I think I've been observed some 15 times this year as they're clocking and checking that I'm teaching correctly. But there is a limit to it. You can just tell the students that information is there and it's their job to find out the colour. And then you've got to make an edible Hertzberg diagram. And my idea here is that you can set them the task of just randomly going through stars. But if you give them the Hertzberg-Russell diagram and this way of restructuring the information, they'll start to hunt for stars of a particular method, a particular way to look at them. So this is just changing the structure rather than giving the information formally. You give them a task. And so rather than just randomly go, if you randomly go around the galaxy, you'll only actually fill up a small section of the Hertzberg-Russell diagram. The most of the other parts, the interesting parts, the little bright jewel stars, which are the white dwarfs and the big red giants, they're relatively hard to find. And so if you randomly go along, statistically you won't find them. But if you've got the task of filling up your Hertzberg-Russell diagram, you have to communicate it. So the idea is to make this a group activity where they actually decide how to access the information and you have some guides on how they build the model. So the way that I think of building a model is that they have some icing, some fondant icing, I don't know how you pronounce it, but this is not the white, just the sugary, I suppose you could have just the icing sugar and icing mixture, mix it up, and you have it coloured, so you can have a red tub, a yellowy tub, a white tub, and a blue tub, and you can mix these together to get the different colours. Now, one of the colours of the stars you don't get is green, so if you mix the yellow and blue, you will get green, and there's no green stars. So that's an interesting point to make. And so they have to mix these colours together to get the colour of the star. Then you've got the star size. You'll represent the radius of the star by the actual the radius of the star. In the Hertzberg-Russell diagram, will represent the brightness of the star. Now, again, if you have a cake mixture, what I think is a slab of butter cake, in which you can take a small section of cake out and sculpt it. So I think slightly robust, not very flaky cake, but fairly usable cake, which they can carve and make it a rough circle, an appropriate size. So they have the problem ahead of how are they going to represent the different brightnesses of stars with different radiuses or radii, and still fit it in. So the one is a logarithmic scale. So rather than teaching the logarithmic scale, that's a solution to how they can represent this diagram, because if they did it with a linear scale, they'd have, you know, a tiny cake crumb and a huge big cake at the other side. So that, so the solution to it is building it here. So you create the cake. You get your sphere of cake. So you cut up the circle, you thread a string through it. So because you're going to hang this Hertzberg-Russell diagram, and there are stars in this Hertzberg-Russell diagram. So a little piece of cake which has been cut into a rough sphere represents the star. Now, what I was going to say is that in a senior class, because you've got the material to go so fast, this is not necessarily appropriate for it. But for a junior class, you've got less material over a longer time and deeper learning. So, yeah, I don't suggest this for Year 10, but for Year 7, 7 class. This is at high school, or even an interest group on astrophysics, a science club, lunchtime activity, is to build the Hertzberg-Russell diagram. Now, what happens is that your very bright stars have to appear in the upper part of the diagram, so therefore they have a shorter length of string. So you have a rod where the string is threaded around, so they can adjust the height. And for the different colours of stars, they mix up different icing mixtures. So we draw very red. As the colour changes, they should be able to mix the icing mixtures. And I suppose what is interesting is that you can have a sort of a red, orange, yellow, white, then white with blue to come across. Now, I think it's very interesting that you can't mix white and yellow together. Blue and yellow together, you'll get green. And if you actually look at the, colour graph of all possible colours, squashed into a two-dimensional graph to go with the three cone cells that we have in the eye. We have three cone cells as a sort of a trick where we see purple a particular way by mixing our blue and red cone cells. Our red cone cell has a little purple sensitivity tacked onto it. So when we see ultraviolet, we see it blue, but our red cone cells start firing, so we add an extra signal to it, and so we see ultraviolet as purple. So we reuse a colour to give us purple vision. But so it's interesting that the black body curve, this is the heat colours, track through this our human vision, such that green is absorbed, is avoided. We have no green stars. Green stars. The end product here is the Hertzberg-Russell diagram with cakes to eat, it's iced and it's hung up and photographed, and at the end the students can eat it. And so there's all this cognitive processing as you go through actually setting up, icing it, eating it, you've got everything of a particular colour is there. Of course, you can have these very large red cakes. And the interesting thing is that the actual size of the cake is the brightness of the star, not its actual radius. And this is a point to make with the model. But you're using a radial dimension of a star as an indicator of its brightness, and sort of backing that up with the vertical the vertical scale. So you could have them all the same size, but this is sort of a way of getting across. So this is probably quite confusing to make the point that the radius of the star is actually these isoradius lines which cut across the Hertzberg-Russell diagram. And so this is, I suppose, for your differentiated students to actually lead them to a point. And I suppose this is one of my criticisms of bolt-on differentiation is that you want to lead your class, your cohort, in a large funnel axis. This is broad, undifferentiated, but challenging activities. But when the activities conclude, their conclusion trajectory, you have differentiation at that point. So there may be enough for some people to know that this is a diagram not of space, but a conceptual graphical, a concept space, putting stars in concept space. That may be a certain level. There may be people who can appreciate that they can know more, gain confidence. That may be a certain aspect. So the main objective here is not necessarily the amount that a student can remember, but the actual confidence that they gain in a junior year. So if you had to get two groups of people, some who have done this activity and some who haven't, their confidence that they would gain. Whereas if they just read a text, the effect can actually, for some people, so for some students, doing the activity which slows them down, they'd be better reading a text and they gain confidence that way. But the issue is not the activity and how will they go, it's the validation, or self-validation, the confidence, and also although people may not have confidence in terms of processing the science, they can begin processing on how to do the task or the social aspects of it. So in terms of a sort of multi-dimensional funnel to funnel your students into an activity, this has definitely got a strong point to it. And then at the end, you have these strands of differentiation available about looking into what is the real radius of a star and how that's represented on the Hertzberg-Russell diagram as these isoradius contours which cut across sort of left, upper and tracking down. So there's a lot of sticking points which you can get there. In terms of I suppose a Hertzberg-Russell diagram of educational techniques, this is saying, well, look, we've got this technique, this method, it's suited for junior years, why not move it to junior years? And then once you've looked at that, you have the question at junior years, you're going to have different types of outcomes, and one of the outcomes is confidence attitude is a major outcome rather than actual direct knowledge. The other sort of repositioning is an overt overt differentiation where the differentiation if placed really early on is a social signpost to switch on students that they're not differentiated, they're not in that group. So actually the actual location of differentiation in a lesson is really important, that you place it in such a way that it unlocks further investigation. And another aspect of it is the actual social interaction, sort of broadening the bandwidth of social interaction. So rather than having it purely science, teacher-focused and class-focused, with the student who can put up their hand the most and getting reward, you have a whole series of reward channels available to a child when they interact here, so they can have a reward channel for understanding the material, a reward channel for knowing how to handle cake, or to handle a piece of string or hang it up, or reward channel for getting a group and doing it. And the important thing is that the reward channel, it really doesn't matter where the reward channel they hop onto, it's that they follow that channel through the activity and guide it through. Whereas there tends to be a reward channel to objectively get data, quick short-term data that the child has understood. So this is sort of time zone thinking, that within a period or within a term, I introduce an experience, I get a result, measurable result for a report cycle. Well, this is valid. It sort of also means that the information that you pick up from this process is invalid, because it doesn't get these long-term social movement. So it doesn't pick up so learning which occurs over a few years, or attitude learning, or your relative capacity learning. It's this one of these things where you test and use your tests as a cycle to guide where you're going. You actually start teaching towards the test to optimize your test results. So you've got a feedback loop there. And now that's the way of the world, but it's not necessarily going to work your way forward. So just to recap here, there is the actual bottom layer of attacking learning through different aspects. I'll give another talk later on about how you can teach nuclear fusion with hand movements and do physical activities, dances, to show the life cycle of stars. I'll do that later. But there is, of course, that interest to try and communicate how you would do this lesson. But there's also, besides that new way of doing a lesson, there's a new conceptualization of where the material can be placed and the risk associated with placing it earlier. The way you placing it earlier produces different outcomes from placing it later, where the material is at a position where you can test it. So we tend to place material up at a point where the, say, interest is being flagged, people have already made their decisions about science, sort of bolting the stable door after the horse is bolted, or horse is flown. I've forgotten what the story is. Stories are there. There's many, many more aspects to this, and it's really hard to communicate with fellow teachers who just really haven't thought their way through the bigger question. You say, oh, look, why are the country's science results going down? Why year upon year there's this dramatic drop-off? And they say, well, that's not my problem. My problem is to keep us going in the direction that we're going and get the head of the pack. It's sort of like people, lemmings running off a cliff. They make sure that they're the head lemming, or their kids are the head lemming. And it doesn't really address the overall direction of it. So that's all for tonight. That's for my cardiac work. I've still got a few more minutes to walk along here. I'm overall improving. And I hope in this episode I've sort of communicated some astrophysics, some methods of teaching it, but more importantly, the broader educational view to get a longer-term, more robust outcome for science and teaching and engagement there. So that's all for tonight. And in the meantime, keep on doing science.